You're listening to You Talking to Me with Big JD, where I talk to everybody about anything and everything, different guests and a different topic every week, right here on the All Talk Radio Network. Hello and welcome to You Talking to Me on the All Talk Radio Network. Of course, I'm your host, Big JD, and today we're talking to Ted Boomer, concert promoter, band manager, agent. He's done it all. Welcome to the show, Ted.
Hey, thanks, JD. Good to see you.
Let's start with a little bit of your background in entertainment.
Well, I started, in high school playing in the band, you know, orchestra, band, French horn, upright bass, and then that was back in the late 60s, early 70s, and got into rock bands, and we had a rock and blues band that traveled all over Michigan, Ontario, and Northern Ohio, and then morphed into being an agent. Our agent quit us because he didn't like our drummer because he wasn't the right color, and you can read between the lines on that one. So sure. I ended up booking the band, and I actually, not knowing what I was doing, I was actually doing better than our other agents. So, and then other bands came to me, and then when I was in university, I started my I was booking, St. Clair College, University of Windsor, all the big shows and stuff. And when I got out of university, I had a degree in marketing. Mm-hmm. And I was making more money part-time than the Holiday Inn was going to pay me full-time. So I figured, and after years of being an entrepreneur, I don't know how anyone could ever hire us because we don't fit inside the corporate box. So
yeah,
we become unemployable, so you got to keep moving forward and do what you do.
Do it for yourself, yeah. What did you play when you were, far as a rock band or?
Bass and sing. I was the lead singer.
Okay, yeah.
You can't tell now with this scratchy voice, but.
Maybe you can. Were you, you were the singer in the band and the bass player? So did you have less members than usual, like a three-piece maybe or something, or did you actually...
We four or five.
Okay.
One of our early bands, we had like a seven-piece horn. We went through that whole Earth,
I was going to say, fire. Did you have the horn section and stuff?
Yeah, like, yeah. I always loved horns, but it's tough to make a living with a three-piece horn band unless you got a house gig, you know?
Yeah. That's cool. And then it was kind of... you kind of got moved into being the group's agent. And so,
and then from there, from there, then I started booking our local university and college, and being next to Detroit, I used to bring all the black bands into Toronto.
Okay,
because
that's why you were playing in the band and stuff.
No, I sort of
a little bit later,
kind of at the same time, and mm-hmm. then I realized from dealing with all the pros that I was never going to be Jack Bruce at an early age, so I figured, heck with this. And after I saw Jimi Hendrix, I just, me and the guitar player, we just about broke our instruments.
Where'd you see Jimmy?
Cobble Hall. I saw Jimmy twice. Once he was the most amazing artist in the world, and once he was absolutely horrible.
Oh, yeah?
and you can figure out why. But
sure. I'm fascinated, though, when somebody says they saw somebody that's, great like that I would not have been able to see in my lifetime, but...
Well, you're a little young, but in Detroit,
so cool.
Detroit was and probably still is the number one music city in the world. I mean, there's New York, Memphis, Nashville, and Detroit. And Chicago for electric blues, but Detroit could have been Chicago if they didn't tear down Hastings Street for I-94. So history and different things. But Detroit, we're so lucky having CKLW. In the old days, it was the biggest radio station. Detroit had... Motown, so
yeah.
Barry came over with his hot new signing, Stevie Wonder, and CKLW with their 50,000 watts. You can hear him in Jamaica, you can hear him in Northern Ontario. So we had the second biggest radio station in the world outside of Radio Free Europe. So we grew up, Windsor was lucky geography because we were right next to rock and roll capital of the world, Detroit.
A lot of good live albums recorded in Detroit.
Oh, yeah. And that was because the audience was, it's a blue-collar town, automotive town, work-hard, play-hard town. It's similar to Windsor. We're just the younger sibling of Detroit.
So you were the agent, which you probably still do some of that stuff, band management, representation more?
Well, I just put people together, call this guy. I mean, I manage one band, and that's a full-time job just about in itself, the Detroit Women out of obviously out of Detroit.
Yeah, I definitely want to get into that a little bit later. What are some of the differences like between being an agent, being would you say that being management is basically representation, representing a certain band? Is that
a manager
thing kind of?
Usually what happens is, you know, in the early days of any band, the manager is the manager agent. Everyone, you know, just because you're the bass player doesn't mean you can't sign a sponsorship deal.
Right.
You know, if you're bumping into someone at the Walmart store and they got money in their pocket and want to invest in a band, you don't have to say, call my agent in New York.
Yeah.
Sit down, buy him a coffee and get into his wallet and sign a deal, you know. But then that's usually how a lot of the bands, and that's one thing about technology today, is you don't need all these layers of bureaucracy. Just because you have a law degree and you're an expert in music, you need them to put the final touches to any deal. But
sure.
Anyone could sell. I mean, you just have to believe in it. Mm-hmm. And so an agent, manager, as a band gets bigger, you have to split it up. You know, I mean, some of these big artists or big companies they start off with one accountant. They started out with a bookkeeper. And then when they got bigger, they got an accountant and a bookkeeper.
Right, yeah.
And then when you become Bill Gates, they have a whole accounting firm, right?
People.
I mean, as you grow bigger, you need more people.
So through this long career, you also were, you owned a club or more than one club?
Four clubs, yeah. I
locally or?
Yeah, my first one was right on the Detroit River, Danny's. It was a great big 700-seat rock club.
Yep.
And I had that for a couple of years, then went into California's Musical Roadhouse, and that was our biggest. That ran 7 years, really strong. It was a 1,000-seater, and we did all the big acts. And then, you know, when I got into my 40s, I started my festivals, and they started getting so big that I figured either stay with the restaurant hospitality industry or stay with the festivals. And I liked the festivals better because it wasn't a 7 day a week, don't burn the hamburger,
right,
how many waitresses, how many bars. It was more artsy and more, and you can maybe make more of a difference. And I had more fun at it. And as you evolve, it's not all about money. In the early days, you're just trying to feed your family and pay down your mortgage. But after a while, you sort of find your own place, and the blues is kind of like addictive. And once you get into it and you realize how important the people are, and you meet them, they inspire you, and then it's not all about money. It's more about the art side, and we're having more fun and doing festivals than we used to in the nightclub business.
I can certainly attest to how well the clubs did back in the day because I played at them, so it was a lot of fun. You represent musicians. Are there other entertainers that you've represented?
Well, when we had our nightclub, California's Musical Roadhouse, it was just like, it was a themed nightclub. It was live entertainment 7 nights a week. Mm-hmm. We did everything from blues to rock to, you know, the odd country act, but it was mainly top 40. I mean, back in the 80s when the hair bands were in, we did every hair band, and, you know, but I was always a southern rock kind of guy. I always liked the Allman Brothers and those type of acts. So we had 38 Special and all the different bands.
Yeah.
So whoever was breaking through the market, and we had partnerships with some of the big Detroit radio stations. So if, like, for instance, Kim Mitchell broke his record, Go for Soda, at our club. Mm-hmm. Honeymoon Suite, we had The Rockets, Mitch Ryder, everyone, just about everyone who came through. It sort of, you know, evolved into being one of the top 10 concert plays and coming through Canada. And we were, again, geography helped us. If you're in Toronto on your way to Chicago, we were a good stop-off point.
Right. So you brought in, it was all bands though, there were whether magicians or any kind of other entertainment like that or anything? Or
well, we did, we sort of, by a fluke, we had volleyball courts, and that was our gimmick. I mean, we had the palm trees and all that. It was like a big Beach Boy kind of thing, although all our music was totally different than that, of course. But it was themed. I mean, you know, all our staff was in all the goofy, I mean, everyone wears them now, but back then, I mean, we had to search all over the world to try to find all those cheesy
surf stuff
that wasn't around. It wasn't around. So we had three volleyball courts, and we had like a almost like a bowling league, only we had a volleyball league, and we had it running 4 days a week. And we had like 150 teams, you know, like 1,000 volleyball players.
Wow.
And we had this one guy that challenged, and I played too, and our team was maybe in the... We were a B-plus team. We had the A-plus teams were, you know, university and college top players. this guy challenges our team. He bet me a case of beer that he could beat us 1-6. And he went out there and he beat us in front of like 500 people watching. He beat us all three games. And our whole team was devastated because we were a good team. Like out of 150 teams, we were like in 23rd spot. Which, you know, we weren't just a bunch of hackers. We were pretty good hackers. And he just wiped the floor with us and everyone's like so humiliated. And I was out in the golf or out in the volleyball court figuring out how the heck can we promote this guy. So I sat down with him and I said, you know, what the heck is this all about? It was... there was a guy I remember as a kid watching, Eddie Fainer, who was king in his court. And he was a three-man team would play your top team in town. And he traveled all over, you know, United States, Canada, probably around the world. This guy pitched from second base. I mean, he was just he was a freak show. I mean, and he would go in front of 5,000 people or 3,000 people in the middle of Iowa or in the middle of Manitoba and the smaller markets. And, kind of like, what's the basketball team?
Harlem Globetrotters?
He was like a Harlem Globetrotter kind of guy. And so that's what I'm thinking out there. As this guy's mopping the floor with us, I'm thinking, this guy's a Harlem Globetrotter. This is Meadowlark. This guy, like, how can he do what he does? So I ended up signing him up, and within 2 years, we had him on MTV, and he was traveling the world. We had Budweiser was sponsoring him. He was going, we did the whole college tour, you know. And we turned it into a real promotion. If you beat him, you're 6-1. If you beat him, you got $1,000 prize. And he was so good that we had to go out and get great teams because I had a sponsor that gave me 8 $1,000 gift certificates. So out of 50 games, I wanted him to lose 8. Because if you don't lose, it's almost like you're bribing the other team to win.
Right.
And he was so good that you couldn't beat him unless you had a real top team. And, you know, the top teams, once they figure them out, you know, you can beat them. But by the time you figured them out, it was usually 8-1 and the crowd was on his side. So he had momentum going. So we toured all over the U.S. and Canada. And so that, other than music, that's the only gimmicky thing. And we sort of evolved into it. And we had a lot of fun with it.
Obviously, the wheels get turning for you when you see something that's promotable or...
Well, yeah, it's... and we did the same thing. We invented this thing, the mechanical surfboard. And all it is, it was just a rip-off of the mechanical bull. I mean, we got a patent on it and all that stuff. And I've never invented anything in my life. It was nothing more than a dumb idea that we came up with. And I was sitting around our bar with all, you know, being in Windsor, we're an automotive town. All the guys sitting around the bar were all engineers and guys, you know, millwrights and all that. So I sketched it on a napkin and after a couple cases of beer, we had the whole plan down and we had it built. And next thing you know, 2 years later, we're on MTV and we're touring all over. So I don't know. You just run with the wave and, you know, sometimes they crash. Sometimes
no pun intended there. Yeah. The wave and California's, it all fits in, ties in together. Oh,
we were the opening act for the Beach Boys on a couple tours. I mean, it was just shtick. I mean, it's all, you know, Barnum and Bailey circus, you know. But if it makes people laugh, have a little fun with it, you know, and it was a TNA show with bikinis and the whole thing. And we had a lot of fun.
What about, like, locally? Is there any, you know, prominent people in that locally that you worked with or that you played with that are come to mind?
Well, locally, is Detroit local? To me, it is.
I think Detroit's fairly local. It's a big part of our city.
Being in our industry, there's never really a lot of barrier. I mean, I consider Toronto and Detroit local for a Windsor guy because we're only 3 hours away or five minutes away. I worked with Mitch Ryder on a lot of different things in the early days. The Rockets, did a couple shows in the early days with Bob Seger and Ted Nugent and those guys. I managed for a brief time Carolyn Franklin, Aretha's sister. And you bump it. We've done hundreds of charity events and stuff, so you get to you get to meet a lot of interesting folks doing that type of thing, you know, governors and chief of police type of people. And you know, people that run hospitals and musicians and professional athletes. And we're lucky being across from Detroit. I mean, when the Tigers won the 84 pennant, we had all the guys over, and Arena Football, we used to do all kinds of promotions with them. Did a lot of promotions with the Red Wings and the Pistons and CFL, the Hamilton Tiger Cats, and charity golf outings. You have all the boxing. We've got a great boxing market with Detroit and Windsor. We've had Tommy Hearns and all these guys over. We used to do closed circuit you know, where people would now, but back in the 80s, you had to pay $20, $30, $40 to see a closed circuit fight, you know, and because Tommy Hearns was so big at the time, every time there was a big Vegas fight, we'd bring in his coaches that weren't down in Vegas because they had such a big team at Kronk, so they might have 15 guys trainings, all coaches, but we would have three or four of them and do the national anthem and have all our staff dressed up in tuxedos, and we, you know, made it look like a little Vegas even though it was closed circuits, and we do every shtick that we could, you know.
How about, are there any changes in the industry actually that you could pinpoint or that, you know, come to mind that are...
Well, the biggest, probably more change in the music industry. When I started in the early 70s, it was, you know, get a record company, go on tour, get tour support. Those days are pretty much gone. Mm-hmm. Today, for $10,000 or $20,000, you can put out your own album. You know, with the internet, you can manage yourself. I'd say that in the big labels, you know, with all the pirating, you know, people ripping off of websites and so on.
Right.
So really, it's gone really back to the 50s, where if you had a record, you got in a car. You got, back then, it was a station wagon, you know. Mm-hmm. Howlin' Wolf and Chuck Berry, they didn't have vans and diesel, you know, all the neat vehicles we got now, tour buses. I mean, that was, you know, not really the way they traveled. And it's kind of gone down that. It's more...
self-promotion again, kind of.
Dave Matthews and these type of bands, they made it because the audience wanted them to make it, not because they had a billion-dollar record company throwing money at buying payola and getting their record played. So it's kind of like it's free enterprise to the max. The ones that survive were destined to survive because the audience made them survive, whereas in the early days, if you had enough money and you put enough people's name on your publishing, you know, if you look back at some of these old 50s records, you see people that never wrote a record in their life as a publisher only because they were making the royalty vig on the back end.
Right.
But, you know, with different anti-racketeering laws and different payola things, finally that's changed. But a lot of the artists didn't even mind if you talk to the old style artists like Johnny Johnson and them. Johnny never made a penny in royalties, you know, and he died... with dignity. He's in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. We lost Johnny a couple of years ago, but he wrote all the music and Chuck Berry wrote all the words. But Johnny thought because he couldn't write music, like the notes down, he didn't think he was writing the words, but he didn't understand that he was the soundtrack to Chuck Berry's music, and without the music, it's just a poem.
What about venues, especially locally? Why, you know, some have been around a lot longer than others, and some seem to just kind of fade away?
There's been an old thing that I've always, the old time guys, when I started in the nightclub game, if you had a run in a nightclub 5, 6, 8 years, you were, you know, things change and it's always a new gimmick. And now it's chains, you know, you got Fridays and Applebee's, and you've got so many chains out there. That's really changed the days of when we started, when there was no themed anything, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But today it's... there's not a lot of live entertainment clubs because rap and pop music and everything. I mean, it's cool to have a disc jockey. When I grew up, I remember seeing Three Dog Night at Cobo Hall back in 72 or 3. We're in high school, and then a year, and they were number one in the world. They, I think the Guess Who were the top grocer maybe in 70, and then Three Dog Night 71, and then Zeppelin came out and blew away everyone's records. But Three Dog Night went from being a superstar to almost thrown out of the business because they realized that they weren't writing their music. Mm-hmm. And back in that day, if you didn't write it and record it and sing it, you were a fraud. And today, you know, even the great songwriters, half the record is written by other Nashville songwriters. So it's different. It used to be, you know, if you had a tattoo, you better been in the Navy. Now everyone has a tattoo.
Right.
But if it was old school World War II, you were either in a bike club or in the Navy.
Yeah, right.
And if you weren't in the Navy and you had a tattoo, you were a fraud. Mm-hmm. And that's how it was in music. If you didn't write the song, but today everyone covers everyone's stuff. But back then, it had to be your song. And Three Dog Night got toasted. I mean, they were one of the best vocal bands of all time. But they had other people writing their songs. And no one knew it. But when they did, they turned their back on them.
Some interesting points there on the industry and how it's changed. And we're going to take a break. We're talking to Ted Boomer, concert promotion and management, artist management, agenting, etc. And we'll be back. You talking to me. I'm Big JD. Back right after this. Okay, Big JD here. You talking to me. The All Talk Radio Network. Streaming internet radio out of Las Vegas. I'm talking to Ted Boomer. I want to talk to you a little bit about some of the other accomplishments or maybe personal goals that you've met through your career. I know there's a Mayor's Award. You got gotten a Heroes Award, Promoter of the Year. Tell me a little bit about some of those.
The Mayor's Award, I mean, every town has an arts council, and they give out some awards. So I was lucky enough to win that. I think it was in 2000. Probably the biggest, my proudest accomplishment was the Blues Foundation in Memphis, which is the governing body for all the blues around the world. They gave me the 2006 Promoter of the Year. So it's proof, kids, that if you stay long enough at anything, it doesn't matter how good you are, sooner or later they'll come to your number and you win the raffle prize.
There you go, kids.
And we've done a couple of silly... another thing that we're really proud of is 81, 82, and 87, we won the Detroit Free Press's Reader Poll for a number one nightclub in Detroit. But which was amazing about that, the question was, what's your favorite club in Detroit? And they gave it to a Windsor club, so it was pretty amazing when the question didn't even ask. It didn't say Detroit Windsor, because they don't
right,
even.
Right.
So that was pretty amazing to us.
And what club was that for? Which one?
Well, the first one was Danny's Canadian Club.
Okay, yeah.
And the second one was California's Musical Roadhouse.
Okay, both the big clubs.
And we other silly things. We had the first rock flight in Canada, where today they do a lot of them. You know, win a pair of tickets to go see Rush in Vegas. We did one in the late 70s. We had a local band that was getting airplay in Detroit. Or not in Detroit, London, England. They were charting top 20 in England for a bit. And then we got a local radio station that thought it was really cool. We got Air Canada throwing a pair of tickets. We got the hotel on the back end. We basically sent them over for a week, and it was the first rock flight in Canada. I don't know. Some people said in the States, too, but I'm not sure on that one. And the craziest, zaniest, stupidest, most lunatic thing we've ever done is, as a promoter, you're always going out there trying to get... You have an idea, and you try to sell it. So limousine companies will, donate a limo or two to bring the acts to your show, because they've got the limos, you've got the advertising, you give them tickets, it's good for their company, it's good for us.
The usual thing, it sounds
like.
Yeah, the usual.
We've had boats and we've done trains. We had a blues cruise from here to London, Ontario with Via Rail. We turned the whole train. We had bands on the train, and that's been done before. I mean, everything you've done, it's probably been done 100 years ago. You think you've invented something, but they've done trains and planes. We did a plane. Someone donated a 737. And we had a wedding, and we had a contest, win a wedding. So we gave the bride and groom, and they had hundreds and hundreds of people. And it was done through our radio station and our TV station and our local newspaper. And the winners got to be married at the festival, and then we got an airplane. A company gave us a 737 for an hour. We put the bride and groom up in the plane with 180 guests. We had Father Guido Sarducci do the whole thing. And we had a band on the plane. And they got married, and then they did the mock wedding again at the festival in front of 10,000 people. So
that is wild, a wedding on an airplane.
It was beyond stupid. It worked. I don't think with Homeland Security you could get away with that kind of stuff.
Maybe.
That was in 99.
And a blues wedding to boot.
Oh, there were champagne on the... Oh, yeah, it was... We had a Juno Award winner, Johnny V out of Calgary, Alberta, B.B. Queen out of Detroit.
Yeah.
And they actually removed some seats so we could have an area for the band. And the hardest part of that was finding the right type of batteries so that we could power the PA system.
Because, right, yeah.
There's no extension cord that goes 40,000 feet in the air. So, but that was insane.
You don't want to draw all the power from the airplane.
No, that would be bad.
Sounds like some great accomplishments and an amazing career. I want to move on now to a band that you're representing. You're managing a band out of Detroit, Michigan.
Yes.
The Detroit Women.
Yeah, they're an excellent act. I fell into them. I booked them at three of my festivals. And they did so... I've never seen that kind of reaction from... they've won 25 Detroit Music Awards. So, and even an average band in Detroit is usually better than most, because Detroit's such a huge music city. So they got so many great musicians, so many great players, and so on. But this act, they've got seven lead singers. It's kind of like having seven Tina Turners, and each one of them takes a song, and then they've got their sound is they've almost got a heavy six piece background singers. So it's almost like you have your own gospel choir or horn section.
Right.
And each girl is a lead singer. And there's no star of the band. There's seven girls that are the star. And they've got a, you know, a kick butt Detroit R&B rockin' band behind them.
Mm-hmm.
And they just, everywhere they go, they just tear up the... They just tear up the festival. You got 30 acts on the bill, and they're all great acts. And for some reason, they leave. All they're doing is talking about the Detroit women. So
mm-hmm.
I met the gals, and they're just amazing people, and they work so hard, and they're so humble. So I just, they asked me to manage them, and I couldn't say no. And now we
were they represented previously, or what was happening?
No, they were fairly new. They were only about a year old. I mean, they had an agent. They had a publicist. I mean, and the leader, Kate Hart, I mean, she's been nominated four times for a Grammy, so she's no rookie. I mean, she's a real pro, and all these girls have lead singers in their own bands, but to mm-hmm. come together and got behind this project. And since I've been managing about a year now, we just signed a deal with Crown Records out of Germany. Mm-hmm. We're doing our first European tour coming up in October.
Great.
And they're playing a lot of the big festivals across Canada and the U.S. And we're just out there swinging the bat just like any other band, making some noise, selling some records, and doing every festival and casino gig that we can, and corporate parties. That's the beauty of the gals. They have they're very wide appeal.
Uh-huh.
And four or five of the girls are right out of the Baptist churches in Detroit, so we're putting on a gospel album. They've got a gospel show that's doing very well. So they're mainly a high-energy R&B band, kind of think Tina Turner.
With a broad musical range.
Yeah, well, they're
nice thing. To different areas.
Yeah, they're a 11-piece band, and they've got seven songwriters. So one's folky, one's straight-ahead blues, and... some have poppy versions, so they're not just a blues band, or not mm-hmm. just a rhythm and blues band. Or
I got to ask you, I mean, when there's a 4-piece group, 5-piece group, and gets a little bit bigger than that, does it get a little hectic sometimes with so many people involved, or is that?
It would, except that the leader Kate Hart is such a magical person. I mean, she, mm-hmm. the team it exists only because they. They want to exist. I mean,
right.
To have seven, everyone says, you know, seven partners, oh my God, you know. But they're so involved in the music, and there's so much magic that happens on stage. That's what inspires them. It's, you would think it's impossible to keep 11 people on the road, and it's very financially tough.
Mm-hmm.
But every time they play, they get the same reaction. I mean, they're like Mike Tyson. Every time in the ring, you're going to get knocked out. They knock out every audience everywhere.
Great.
And so all the tough parts of the travel, and I mean, we need 3 minivans to travel in, I mean, mm-hmm. or a tour bus. And we can't afford the tour bus. We're not quite at that level. But it's the once they hit the stage, and when it's all said and done, they're inspired, and they keep it going. And it's difficult to have a band that size on the road. But the music keeps them solid as glue, and... as long as that chemistry and magic still
right,
there.
The more they want it, the better it's going to
be.
Yeah,
and as long as the audience reaction is the same. If the audience turned cold to them, and then all of a sudden it would implode just like every other good idea. Mm-hmm.
Okay, just wanted to mention quickly the Detroit Women, their website?
DetroitWomen.org.
DetroitWomen.org, okay. And there's lots of information on there. I was looking at the site, and there's lots of stuff on there, some music and a lot of information about the group and...
you know, where they're touring,
and the
all,
show and,
yeah, all their merch, yep. you know, up to date. They've got a movie coming out this fall called We Are Not Good Girls. It's a documentary. A film crew toured with them on 5 cities, 7 shows last year, and they're just putting the finishing touches in New York to the editing, and you know, be debuting at film festivals and that type of thing.
And there'll be information on the website.
Yeah, as it updates. Yeah.
Yep. Great. Okay, we're going to take another break, and then we're going to come back and talk a little more about the Detroit Women, what's going on with them now, where you'd be able to see the group locally, and also want to get into a little bit of the Canada South Blues Society, which you're involved in, and then get on to the Blues Fest here, Southern Ontario Blues Extravaganza with Ted Boomer. I'm Big JD. We'll be back after this. I want to move on to... discuss a little bit about the Canada South Blues Society. What exactly is that, and what's your involvement?
Well, basically, there's 160 blues societies in the world. They're mm-hmm. a nonprofit. Their whole mandates are to keep the blues alive, to promote the local scene, the history of the blues, and so on. Because as bizarre, and we have a different perspective being Canadians looking yep. at Americana music. I mean, the greatest business minds and the greatest promoters in the world are the Americans, you know, Yankee ingenuity. Mm-hmm. And yet they do such a horrible... They only drop the ball, as you see, on maybe very, very few things. And what they really drop the ball on is their history of their music. I mean, they gave the world... The Europeans gave us classical music, and the Scots gave us Celtic music, but the Americans gave us jazz and blues and rhythm and blues, sure, and rock and roll. They invented the whole musical scene, yet, and it all comes out of the blues, yet they've done such a poor job in promoting it. Mm-hmm. And so the blues societies were started back in the 70s and so on. I mean, they had folk societies as well. There's jazz societies. I'm sure there's country societies. I mean, there's Beatle fan clubs. So yep, it's kind of like a fan club in one way, although their mandate is to keep the blues alive, and most of them do a pretty good job of it. And we started the Kansas Blues Society basically because our festival was getting so big and we had so many volunteers, and I wanted to do something for the volunteers, because it worked so hard at the festival, and then, you know, it's only a one-day deal.
So the festival came first for you.
Yes, and it usually works the other way. It's usually a blues society.
That's like, what I would have thought, yeah.
Yeah, a blues society of a bunch of teachers and blues purists, you know, in the 70s on a beach in California going, let's, you know, and they start the blues society, and then it morphs into the San Francisco Blues Festival.
Festivals so that they can keep it alive, right?
Well, we sort of did it ass backwards. We did a festival, then it got big, and then I wanted to do something for our volunteers, so we dump like $20,000 a year to support them.
Yep.
And they formed their own board of directors, and with the mandate, and we sign up with the Blues Foundation down in Memphis, so now we're card holding. It's like being part of the National Chamber of Commerce.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we do a Blues in the Schools program like so many of the others, and we do about 10 shows a year. We started Canada's first and only blues museum, and we took all the memorabilia from 30 years of doing blues, and the Martin Scorsese Foundation gave us a nice grant this year, which really bailed us out, and we're having fun with it. And we do some local fundraising. We do an annual show for the Humane Society, and we do one for the Essex Kent Building Trades Injured Worker Foundation. And we've done things with hospice. And
local people can get involved. I noticed on the site that you can join the
Blues
Society.
And so, just like any Blues Society, if you want to get involved in any Blues Society, whether you're in Dallas, Texas, or Des Moines, Iowa, or Winnipeg, Manitoba,
get in touch with the local society.
Yeah, and you just basically go to the Blues Foundation website. Imagine, just Google it, and they've got a list. So Iowa's doing a great job. I think there's 5 or 6 blues societies in Little Iowa. You know,
yep,
and there are certain hot pockets in New York. Upstate New York's got some great ones. Florida's got a bunch of good ones. Texas, Dallas, Texas got a huge one. And, of course, California's got a whole bunch of them. So every city's basically got...
And locally, what's your website?
Bluessociety.ca.
Bluessociety.ca.
Yeah.
Okay, so folks, listeners can check out that if you're local, and like you said, do the search for
and go to the Blues Foundation and and join up. St. Louis has got a great one. Kalamazoo's got a great one. They're all over.
They're all over. Great.
160 in the world, and I imagine I think there's 15 in Canada. The U.S. has got pushing 100, I believe. And then, you know, they're in Germany, they're in France, they're all over the world.
It's great that you do that and keeping the blues alive. Of course, the blues being what I like to call it, a universal language. And what started for you first, as you mentioned, is the Blues Fest. It's
Well, I got, I started the Blues Fest in 95. I used to book a lot of the acts for the Detroit Blues Festival. Mm-hmm. And it imploded because the promoter ran off with all the money and left everyone high and dry, and really hurt blues in Detroit back in the early 90s. So I waited till all the, you know, the crime scene had cooled down, and then I figured, well, now Detroit, you know, one of the major music cities in the world, doesn't have a blues festival, so we slid in the back door and started ours. Right. And now we're Detroit's Blues Festival because
over here, sure,
we branded it, and you know, we're twin sisters. So we started off on the main street, right on Olet Avenue, created so much chaos on the main street that they kicked us off that street. And we basically had a plan that we would create so much chaos that they would finally give us what we wanted. We wanted the waterfront. And
right.
They gave us the waterfront, and it's a beautiful, I mean, we're right on the banks of Detroit River, mm-hmm. right in front of Casino Windsor. You're looking right at the GM building. It's one of the best urban sites, I think, in the world. I mean, Telluride out in Colorado has a fabulous blues festival up in the mountains. I mean, we don't have the Rockies or whatever, but we've got the Detroit River and Detroit skyline. And
right.
So we've got a great location. And it just, you know, we built it one sponsor at a time, one act at a time. And
how does this tie in with London?
Well, the biggest problem we had in the early days was, I mean, we had lots of connections from being in the business so many years. But why would Buddy Guy come to Windsor, Ontario when he could play San Francisco? I mean, mm-hmm. you know, we only have 200,000 people and we don't even show up on the radar. Billboard magazine would never know where the heck Windsor is. You know where Windsor is if you're in the automotive industry because, right. you know, we're the automotive capital of Canada. But musically, we're not known. So what we did is we started off, we had a twin festival in Novi, Michigan. So we had a shtick, we had a gimmick. If we were booking your, say you're James Cotton, you mm-hmm. play Friday in Novi, Saturday in Windsor, all under the banner of Blues Fest International.
Okay.
And then we had Novi going for 3 years. We lost our venue, so I picked up Novi and moved it to London, Ontario. So now London's only 2 hours away. Mm-hmm. So same thing, you know, if you're a blues traveler, you're playing Friday in Windsor and Saturday in London. So we could offer an act a two-day play instead of a one-day play. And we picked the week that was the same time as the Ottawa Blues Festival, which is the biggest in Canada. They're huge. Kalamazoo's Blues Festival is the same weekend. So we had some synergies amongst our region between Kalamazoo and Ottawa, Windsor, and London. And then we added Thunder Bay, Ontario. And this year we just added Milton, Ontario, called the Escarpment Blues Festival,
okay.
which is the same weekend. So, you know, we're trying to, we've got, for instance, Los Lobos is Thursday, Windsor, Friday, London, Saturday, Milton. You know, they just
yeah. I wanted to get into that actually a little bit of some of the maybe past artists and you know some of the present artists because we have the Blues Fest coming up actually. What are the dates actually of the
July 12 to 15?
12 to 15 local here in Windsor.
July, yeah, and it's thebluesfest.com. Everything's up there. So if you punch London, it'll tell you the London lineup. If you punch Windsor, it'll tell you the Windsor lineup.
Okay, so you got the groups are online there, the artists that are coming.
Yeah.
And just so like local people, I'm sure, know how big the Blues Fest is. For people that are from a little further out maybe or that maybe want to travel, come down to the festival, just maybe name some of the big acts you've had in the past because there's a lot of big groups.
Junior Wells. In fact, Junior played our last show, his last live show here, and then he did the Blues Brothers up in Toronto, and then mm-hmm. he got ill, and we lost Junior.
Right.
Buddy Guy's played a number of times. Blues Traveler, George Thorogood, Dr. John, Dickie Betts, Little Feet, Buckwheat Zydeco, Billy Wyman and the Rhythm Kings, James Cotton, Leon Russell, Robin Trower. This year, we've got a really nice lineup. Los Lobos, Robert Cray, mm-hmm. Dave Mason from Traffic, Colin James, who's our big Canadian superstar,
yeah.
Watermelon Slim, Walter Trout, Detroit Women. I got to put my girls on.
That's right. I just wanted people to get an idea, especially if you're not locally, that there's a lot of big acts playing at the Blues Festival. So
yeah, we're number two in Canada, probably number 12 in North America right now. We can never break the top 10. There's too many people doing a better job than we are, or bigger sponsors, you know.
The whole thing sounds, and it is for most people that come and see the show, and it's just, it's incredible, it's amazing, and a lot of great acts and all that, but there's got to be sometimes, you being the promoter, behind the scenes, sometimes things maybe go bad, there may be a little story here and there, perhaps, or...
Yeah.
You know, it's got to get a little crazy.
Well, you're dealing with so many people, and... I won't name names on this one, but one of the biggest stars in the world, I mean, just go on Highway 61, Bob Dylan album, and you'll find out who I'm talking about. But mm-hmm. he was coming in. We were picking him up at the Detroit airport at noon.
Mm-hmm.
Northwest had a big glitch in their computers, so they were 10 hours behind. So by the time, we had our driver waiting at Detroit Metro for 10 hours. So by the time he got in the van, he was like being stung by a hornet's nest. So he was not in a good mood. Then he finds out about an hour before he's playing the next day for us that the Toronto Blues Festival was canceled.
Hmm.
So he was already in a miserable mood because the travel was horrible for him.
Right.
And he just snapped and flipped out. And I I paid him and I got him back to the hotel and I said, "You don't even have to play. Just go home. You're gonna, he's going to have a heart attack." But he just unraveled. So stuff like that happens. But the only time in our life we've ever had an act where we didn't, when you have a show where you have six acts on the bill, we had two acts go down at the very same time for different reasons. We had Rick Emmett, who was from Triumph.
Sure,
big Canadian act. Rick's a big Juno Award-winning Canadian act, and he was doing a duo, just put out a real good jazzy blues album. So, and he's a phenomenal guitar player. So Rick was doing a radio show similar to this, a Detroit live broadcast show, at 5 in the afternoon. And I saw him there because I drove him there, and then I had to run back to the festival. He's on the festival stage at 7 o'clock, and his road manager's called me at 6:30 saying, "Rick can't play." And I said, "What do you mean? I just dropped him off at the hotel." I guess he went for a bite to eat at a downtown restaurant or something, had some bad egg salad sandwich or something, got violently ill. He can't even, I mean, he's thrown up and sick as a dog, and he's on in 30 minutes. And at the same time, I get the Windsor police came to me with a note, because we're down on the waterfront and cell phones don't work so well because you've got, you know, you've got all these microwaves coming from Casino Windsor and all these radio stations, and it really is difficult for communication right on that border. So the cell phones sometimes don't work. And Sonny Rhodes had had his, had car trouble, and he was late. But we didn't know whether he was in Chicago or whether he was in Toledo or whether he was downtown Windsor. So we had two acts, so we have 2.5 hours worth of entertainment that we couldn't fill. And I've got, in real time, I've got 45 minutes. So I've got the band that's playing up there. I'm going, "You're going to play, like, keep going.
Yeah.
So your hour set is now an hour and a half. And I'm going, "What are we going to do? I mean, we can't put the radio on for 2 hours. I mean, I can't juggle that well. How are we going to entertain 8,000-10,000 people? And out of the blue, Greg Serrato, who was on the next day, Greg Serrato was out of Ontario, California. Greg just walks by as we're panicking. I mean, we're ready to have a heart attack. We don't know what to do. I mean, we're desperate. And I said, "Greg, is your whole band here?" He says, "Yeah, somewhere." I says, "Can you play?" He says, "You know, I'll pay you whatever you want. Just, can you play?" He's thinking, "Well, like, yeah, when do you want me on?" 20 minutes. He says, "Well, my bass player's here, but I got my street clothes on. I don't even have a guitar." "Well, we can get your guitar. We can, you know, don't worry about your street clothes. We'll send someone to the store and buy you some stuff or get you back to the hotel." And just, he says, "But I can't play. My drummer's not there." And just as that happened, his drummer turned the corner.
Wow.
So within half an hour, we have Greg Serrato up there playing someone else's guitar. And he bailed us out. If that didn't happen, I don't know, we would have had a riot. But things like that happen. You can't plan for them. They just happened. The most bizarre story that has ever happened to us personally is back in the day, back in the 80s, we had Humble Pie booked. And they were doing a whole tour. And we didn't know it at the time, but their agent was a boiler room guy, meaning he had a tour for Humble Pie, maybe 50 dates. So he had 50 deposit checks in his pocket.
Right.
Steve Marriott didn't know anything about these dates. So this guy was just cashing checks. And these are major nightclubs from Chicago, Detroit, all around North America. So Steve Marriott's name is getting destroyed while the agents funding his drug problem is what happened here. The guy went to jail finally. And he's still in the business now. He's cleaned himself up, which is great. But so at the time, when you're a nightclub promoter or a promoter of anything, if you sell tickets for something that they don't show, they burn down your building. I mean, they are mad. People get very upset being ripped off.
Well,
so Steve Marriott was, so we find out Steve isn't coming. Then we reschedule and reschedule. So finally we realize that we're in the middle of a boiler room. I mean, this is a Briex thing. This is a corporate meltdown corporation cooking the books, right? I mean, it's happened. It does happen. And so we finally booked Steve. The third time we had rescheduled him, we finally got directly to Steve in England because a friend, one of our buddies in Yes, who knew someone who knew someone. We got to Steve, and he didn't know any of this dirt was happening. So he was doing a legitimate tour.
Right.
And we got him rescheduled finally, so all these people that had their tickets could go to the show. So we finally booked Steve, and then his bus breaks down. So I get a phone call. Now, he's on at 11 o'clock at night on a Friday. I get a phone call from at 4:30 on that same Friday that he is in Buffalo, New York, and his bus is broken down. Now, all I know is that if he's not on stage at 11 o'clock after we've burned these people, not once, not twice, this is like, this is round three.
Yeah.
So I'm on the phone with Steve. I said, Steve, don't go anywhere. Give me your phone number. And this is before cell phones and that. This is like 1982. I don't know what to do. I hang up the phone going, how am I going to get him from Buffalo? And my buddy says, well, get him a plane. I says, I don't know anything about planes. So I phone Windsor Airport. Mm-hmm. They give me a number of a guy at London Airport who's got a 6 or 8 seater. So for a couple grand, he flies for Buffalo. And I says, how are you going to do this? Well, as planes fly, because we think in, I think in terms of 70 miles an hour on a I-94 or 75.
Right, yeah, yeah.
Well, it's only about 30-minute flight from London to Buffalo. And from Buffalo to Detroit Airport, or we did Willow Run, is only about an hour and a half at 180 miles an hour, 200 mm-hmm. miles an hour as these planes go. So really, it was mathematically, it worked.
Right.
But I remember the guy in the plane wouldn't shut up, wouldn't open up the door until I slipped the door, the money through his window. It
oh,
was
really?
Just, it was so surreal. And then we get through the border, I'm coming through the border in the Windsor Tunnel, and I realize Steve doesn't have his immigration paper. So now I've got him right, in the back door. I'm an hour away from showtime, so I'm okay. They're shaving in the back seat of the car because their bus had broken down.
Right.
So all their instruments are in the bus. So I get to customs and I say to the guy, "You're not going to believe this. This is Steve Marriott from Humble Pie. We have no immigration. His bus broke down. He couldn't get to the Canadian consulate in Buffalo in time. I could tell you the whole story, but if he doesn't get through the border, they're going to burn down my bar." And the guy looks in the back seat, and they're all Brits. And he says to him, "Sing that 30 Days in the Hole song."
Oh, yeah.
So he sang the intro. The guy looked at me and said, "Good luck on the show." If he didn't let us through, because they had the right to stop us. We had no immigration papers. Now, Monday, when the office of the Canadian Council opened up, but if he didn't let us through, I can't even imagine what would have happened that night if Steve... And Steve went on stage with no sleep, what a road warrior, and just put on the most amazing show. But it should not have happened. It was like Spinal Tap. It was Spinal Tap, a real-life Spinal Tap. And thank God that Customs or Immigration Officer let us through on a story that sounded like total BS, but it was absolute truth.
Yeah. And those guys don't like to believe anything most of the time.
You know, they're tough, especially after 911. But
now,
we're really lucky that the Windsor border, because we get so many musicians, it's the best crossing in Canada. And some of them, we're not that lucky. They get a little goofy, but most of them are much better than we give them credit for.
Obviously, a lot of prep work goes into the festival, and we're running out of time. I just want to kind of touch on some of the volunteers and sponsors that probably make up a huge portion of what goes on with the festivals.
Yeah, sponsorship to any festival is the most important thing, because your sponsorship is it's your insurance policy.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you have $500,000 festival and your sponsors pick up $200,000 of it, that can cover a day and a half of rain.
Mm-hmm.
And your volunteers are very important, because if you had to pay for everything that you did, you would be bankrupt before the doors open.
Sure.
And so what we tie in with about 7 or 8 different charity nonprofits, and some of them make, you know, a couple thousand, some of them make 10 or 15,000. So they have a vested interest in the success of the festival. So they become a partner.
Right.
Without having partnership meetings. They're community groups. We're a community group. We just marry up with the different ones. And many of the festivals do that right across the country. Food banks and downtown missions and all these different places. So volunteers are very important to every festival.
Mm-hmm.
And it sets a spirit, because they're community people.
Sure.
And you give them certain jobs that they don't, that they're qualified for. And it's always nice to go to, it's almost like one great big 20-year reunion of your high school. And you look around, and people draw people. I mean, the bands are the soundtrack, but it's really a way to get people together, because that's really how festivals started. It was a way to celebrate the bringing in of the crop, whether tomatoes or corn, or, I mean, Thanksgiving. It's basically the same thing as the Indians and the early settlement. Thanksgiving started the same way. That's how festivals really started, is at the end of the summer. That's when everyone celebrated the bringing in of the harvest, because that was, and the festival was food and music and all that celebration of we got through it and the community is going to survive another winter.
Sounds good. And give the dates one more time for the Blues Fest here locally.
July 12 to 15.
And the website again?
Thebluesfest.com.
.com. This has been very interesting. Concert promotion, management, agenting, the whole thing is very, very interesting field, and I'm really glad that you took the time out to talk to us about it and shed some light on the whole your career on this subject. It's been great.
Yeah, the whole train wreck of that's the music industry. Just get on the wave and ride it, and you don't know where you're going sometimes, but it can be fun.
I really appreciate having you on the show, Ted. Thanks.
Well, thank you, JD.
This has been Big JD on You Talking to Me and the All Talk Radio Network, and I'll see you next week.
You've been listening to You Talking to Me with your host, Big JD. A different topic, a different guest, every week, right here on the All Talk Radio Network. For more information, visit the website, www.youtalkingtome.ca. That's the letter U, talking, the number two, me, youtalkingtome.ca.